Hollywood, the land of dreams, deals, and the occasional disaster disguised as destiny. Welcome to Behind the Scams, the show where we pull back the velvet curtain on the most audacious frauds, cons, and elaborate deceptions ever staged. I'm Miles, your omnipresent announcer, guiding you through the smoke, mirrors, and misplaced trust that fuel these unbelievable stories. Tonight's tale has it all: flashing cameras, forged invoices, and a producer who could sell sand in the desert and get investors to thank him for the opportunity. His name? David Ozer. A man who climbed the Hollywood ladder, one false promise at a time, leaving a trail of dazzled victims, empty bank accounts, and shattered illusions in his wake. So take your seats, silence your phones, and prepare for the feature presentation. Because in this episode of Behind the Scams, the only thing more unbelievable than the pitch was the con itself.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Behind the Scams, the show where we pull back the curtain on the most audacious frauds, cons, and, well, scams. I'm Sue. Behind the Scams is part of the SOS Media Network, produced by Stamp Out Scams, Inc.
And I'm Nick. And today, Sue, we are diving headfirst into the glitz, the glamour, and the grime of Hollywood.
Oh, I love a good Hollywood story. It's always bigger, isn't it? The stakes, the personalities, the egos. Everything is just magnified.
And it's a world built on dreams, Sue, which also means it's fertile ground for nightmares.
That's the perfect way to put it. For every star on the Walk of Fame, there are 1,000 stories of people who got burned trying to make it. And the people holding the matches often look like they're holding a golden ticket.
Exactly. And the person at the center of our story today is a producer named David Ozer. And on the surface, this guy was the real deal.
Right. Not some fly-by-night operator. He had the resume, the connections. He had, as they say in the biz, juice.
A whole lot of juice. But underneath that shiny Hollywood veneer was a web of lies, impersonations, and straight-up theft that is, honestly, it's kind of breathtaking in its scope.
You really have to have a built-in baloney detector to survive in that town, don't you? It has to be finely tuned, constantly scanning, because the most dangerous people aren't the ones who look shady. They're the ones who look like they belong.
And that's David Ozer in a nutshell. He didn't just look like he belonged, he looked like he owned a room. So we're talking about more than just one bad deal here.
Oh, so much more. We're talking about fake invoices, impersonating investors over burner phones, conning a retired FBI agent, and it might even be a family tradition.
A family tradition. Okay, now I'm hooked.
Right? So buckle up, because this is the story of David Ozer, the Hollywood producer who scammed his way through Tinseltown.
So to really get this, you have to understand who David Ozer appeared to be. The persona is key in these stories.
Yeah, I mean, how many people did he fool?
So many that they're still counting. Industry veterans, newcomers, writers, investors, even, as we'll see, an FBI agent. He had an answer for everything and a smile that made you want to believe it.
That's the true art of the con, isn't it? Making the mark feel like they're in on a secret, not that they're the one being kept in the dark.
The persona was everything. By all Hollywood metrics, this guy was a success. He followed his dad, Marty Ozer, into the business, started in radio ad sales, which is a classic, you know, a classic grind.
Mm-hmm. Cutting your teeth?
Totally, and he climbed the ladder. He was an account exec at 20th Century Fox. He did stints at Starz Media, Sony Pictures Television. These are not small names.
No, that's the big leagues. So he was a legitimate executive. He wasn't just some guy with a business card.
100%. And people who knew him said he was just incredibly charismatic. A little nerdy maybe, but smooth. He'd tell you about his successes, but not in that, you know, brash Hollywood way. It was confident, but he wore it lightly.
The kind of guy you'd trust. He's not puffing his chest out. He's just successful. It seems effortless.
That's the word. He was the guy who could get you a meeting anywhere. He knew people at the big agencies, development execs. He could make things happen, or at least that's what everyone thought. He made them feel like partners in his success, right up until the moment they realized they were just fuel for his fire.
Okay, so you have this picture of a super successful, connected producer. Where does it all start to go wrong? I can only imagine that some of his victims felt foolish afterward.
Of course, but they shouldn't. He didn't just fool people with words. He had the resume to back it up. His entire career was constructed to look like a ladder of success, with each rung making him seem more trustworthy than the last. He weaponized his own credibility.
It's a chilling thought. Using a lifetime of legitimate work as the perfect cover for a series of elaborate crimes, that's precisely what makes this type of scam so ruthless and so dangerous. It's not a stranger on the internet asking for your bank details. It's someone who has painstakingly built a reputation, a career that serves as the ultimate camouflage. His LinkedIn profile wasn't a lie. It was the most effective tool in his arsenal. Each prestigious company, each successful project wasn't just a career move for him. It was an investment in his future ability to deceive.
And when you're in that environment, surrounded by dreamers and risk takers, a healthy dose of skepticism can look like cynicism. You want to believe. People wanted to believe in David Ozer because his success story was the kind of story Hollywood loves to tell about itself. The tragedy is that his story was a complete work of fiction.
So when we talk about this story, it is a bombshell. It starts in mid-2024, and it seems to come out of absolutely nowhere. Suddenly, this 59-year-old producer is hit with a civil suit, and then a federal indictment.
One that sent shockwaves through the industry. Because if a guy like Ozer, with his connections and history, could be doing this, who else could be? It makes you question every deal, every promise. It's a poison that seeps into the well of trust that the entire industry relies on.
Wow, federal. That's a big jump from a civil suit.
A huge jump. And it's over one of his own shows, a supernatural series called Safe Haven.
Okay, it was co-produced by his company, Strong Studios, where he was the president, and Michael Bay's company, 451 Media Group.
Michael Bay. So this is a legitimate project with big names attached. Explosions and everything.
Exactly. This isn't some indie film with a shoestring budget. And the accusation is that Ozer was just siphoning funds directly from the production budget for his own personal use.
It's the ultimate Hollywood sin. You can be difficult, you can be eccentric, but you do not steal from the production. That's sacred money.
It is a violation, plain and simple. Yikes, how much are we talking?
Over $200,000. But that's just a production ripoff. The actual financial damage likely exceeds $600,000 to $800,000, possibly over $1 million when including unpaid contracts and unreported victims.
Okay, not exactly a petty theft. So, Nick, how did he do it? I'm all ears.
This is where you see the beginnings of his methods. The indictment said he created phony invoices from dummy companies.
Classic. Fraud 101.
Right. And get this, he forged his own accountant's signature on the backup documents to make them look legit.
That is bold. Forging your own accountant's signature? Who does that? He was counting on his own position as president of his own studio to be the perfect cover. Who would question the man at the top?
It's amazing nobody caught on sooner. It speaks to the level of trust he built. People don't double-check the work of someone they believe to be a pillar of the community. He exploited that trust to its absolute limit.
It's a perfect storm. An industry primed for belief meets a man whose entire career is a performance of trustworthiness. The victims weren't foolish. They were playing by the rules of a game Ozer had already rigged.
It's an entire ecosystem that inadvertently enables predators like Ozer. The constant churn of projects, the reliance on networking and personal connections over formal due diligence. In many industries, you'd have auditors and compliance officers reviewing a $200,000 invoice. In Hollywood, if it comes from a trusted producer, it often gets a pass.
And because he emailed these fake documents, that's the key. He emailed them. So they cross state lines digitally, and boom, it becomes a federal crime, interstate wire fraud.
And that's what brought the feds in.
That's what opened the door. And believe me, once that door was open, a lot of skeletons were about to come tumbling out. This embezzlement, this was just the beginning of his troubles.
And the accountant must have been horrified to find out his name was literally being used to commit a crime. It's a professional nightmare. Your reputation is your currency, and he just stole it.
So this news breaks, and I imagine the phones start ringing all over Hollywood.
Instantly. Everyone who's in business with David Ozer is in a sudden panic, because speed is everything in that business. Opportunity is fleeting. If you spend weeks verifying everything, the deal might disappear. Ozer knew this and exploited it perfectly. He created a sense of urgency around his fraudulent deals, pushing people to commit before their rational brain could catch up with their ambition.
And one of those people was a screenwriter who's referred to in the case as Cece.
Okay, Cece. So back in January 2024, Cece had given Ozer $30,000. It was supposed to be a short-term bridge loan.
Uh-oh. I don't like the sound of bridge loan in a scam story. It never ends well.
It really doesn't. Ozer told him the money was to help lock in an actor for a different crime series called Endangered. And in return for this $30,000, Cece was promised an executive producer credit and he'd get $40,000 back.
When?
Within 4 weeks.
Wow. An EP credit and a 33% return in a month? That's almost too good to be true.
So is there a moral to this story? If it sounds too good to be true, it absolutely 100% is. A 33% return in a month on a simple loan? That's not an investment, that's a lottery ticket.
Almost, it absolutely was. And this wasn't just pocket change for Cece. This was a precarious time, right? After COVID, the writer's strike, the actor's strike, $30,000 was a huge deal for him and his family.
But the lure of that executive producer credit is powerful in Hollywood. It's a stepping stone. It can change a career. And he knew that. He wasn't just offering money, he was selling a dream, a foothold in a notoriously slippery industry. He tailored the bait perfectly for his target.
So a month goes by and nothing. No money. But Cece isn't freaking out yet. This is David Ozer, right? The successful producer. So when Ozer tells him, just a minor setback, you know how showbiz is, Cece buys it.
He's buying time. Did he have any intention of paying it back?
It's highly unlikely. The pattern suggests this was never a loan in his mind. It was just income. The excuses, the delays, that wasn't a plan gone wrong. That was the plan.
Totally. He's even setting up other meetings for Cece to keep him on the hook. And then, to prove he's working on it, Ozer texts Cece a picture of himself, supposedly at a Chase Bank branch. The text says, "Morning, I'm at the bank to figure this all out."
He sent a photo? That's bizarrely specific. It's all part of the performance.
Right, but summer rolls around, still no money. Now Ozer's not even answering his phone. His whole strategy is to keep the victim on the hook for as long as possible until they just give up, wear them down with promises. It's a war of attrition.
So Cece is getting desperate. He goes back through his emails and finds a number Ozer had given him for an investor, a guy the feds later called JB, an award-winning producer from Dallas. JB had apparently vouched for Ozer on the loan.
Ah, the mysterious third party.
Exactly. So Cece decides to call this JB guy directly. He dials the number, and a familiar voice answers.
Don't tell me. The voice says, "This is David. Hello?"
No way! That's the moment of truth. The moment you have to confront the possibility that this person you trusted, this industry titan, is just a common thief.
Yes way. Cece's just confused. He's like, "David! David Ozer, is that you?" And the guy on the other end seems to realize his mistake, immediately changes his tone, and says his name is Keith, and he's in Minnesota.
So, this is a terrible situation to be in. Cece must have felt his heart sink. He's dialing the number, hoping for a resolution from this JB character, and instead, he gets the one voice he probably didn't want to hear.
He picked up a burner phone he was using to impersonate someone else and answered with his real name. That is an incredible mistake, an unbelievable slip-up.
Cece pushes back. David, I can tell it's you. Where is my money? And Keith just says he doesn't know what he's talking about and hangs up. That's the moment the whole house of cards starts to look really shaky.
It's the moment Cece knows he's been had. And just to make it crazier, Ozer as himself calls Cece back 30 minutes later just to check in. The audacity is just off the chart.
And think about the context for someone like Cece, the screenwriter. This was happening right after the industry had been rocked by strikes. Creatives were financially and emotionally vulnerable. They were desperate to get back to work, to get projects moving. Ozer didn't just see a man with $30,000. He saw an opportunity born from industry-wide anxiety.
He was a predator sensing weakness. The promise of an executive producer credit plus a quick and profitable return on a loan, it was the perfect bait for someone trying to regain their footing. It wasn't just about the money, it was about career momentum. He was selling hope to people who were running low on it.
That makes the betrayal so much deeper. He wasn't just stealing from their bank accounts. He was stealing their chance to recover, to get ahead after a period of intense professional hardship. The casual cruelty of it, especially the follow-up call just to check in after being caught on the burner phone, is what really gets me. It shows a complete lack of a conscience.
And the sad part is, this wasn't even his worst crime. Not even close. This was just one thread in a much larger, more tangled web.
So you might be thinking, where does this kind of behavior, this level of deception, come from? Because this level of deception doesn't just appear out of nowhere.
Well, let's look at the family tree, because the Ozer family had known its share of controversy over the years. This wasn't exactly their first rodeo with scandal. And to understand the spider at the center of it, you really do have to look at where he came from.
Ah, so this is the family tradition you mentioned.
It sure seems like it. So David is the oldest son of a broadcast executive named Marty Ozer. They had this charmed upbringing in an affluent suburb of New York. His mom, Barbara, was a Long Island socialite. We're talking a privileged childhood. Their fate had a tennis court with stands for people to watch his younger brother, Todd, who was a tennis prodigy.
Stands. Not just a court, but stand.
Right. It's learned behavior. It's nurtured. And in the Ozer household, it seems like it might have been part of the curriculum.
And that moment on the phone, it's such a cinematic cliche. The con man getting tripped up by his own lie. But it really happened. It's a moment of pure, unadulterated panic. You can almost hear the gears grinding in his head as he tries to pivot from "This is David" to "I'm Keith from Minnesota." It's the desperate improvisation of a man whose carefully constructed worlds are colliding.
For CC, that must have been a moment of horrifying clarity. The slow-motion realization that the friendly, powerful producer and the shady, evasive investor were the exact same person. The floor must have dropped out of form. Every promise, every meeting, every reassuring text suddenly recontextualized as part of an elaborate deception.
But let's go back to 1992. David Ozer is 27 years old, working at 20th Century Fox. There's a show on Fox called A Current Affair.
Absolutely. This wasn't just any show. It was the kind of television that could make or break a public figure overnight. It had a huge audience and a reputation for sensationalism.
Well, one episode focuses on a rising New York politician named Richard Korn. It paints him as a playboy trying to swindle socialites out of their houses. And two of the women featured in this story, a woman named Shelley Silver and David's mother, Barbara Ozer.
His own mother, on A Current Affair, which is very important context for this story.
Yeah, but after the show airs, Korn sues. He claims he was told his career would be destroyed unless he paid $10,000. He refused, the show aired, and his political career was done.
so alleged blackmail, and for his own mother to be involved in a story on that show while he's working for the parent company, the conflict of interest is staggering. It's a hornet's nest of ethical problem.
And it gets worse. The other woman, Shelley Silver, completely recants her story in a sworn statement. She says everything she and Barbara Ozer said about Korn were lies, and that Barbara orchestrated the whole thing to hurt Korn.
Wow, so this is not a good look.
It's a complete betrayal, and it paints a picture of Barbara Ozer as someone willing to manipulate the media and ruin a man's life for her own reasons.
And here's the kicker. Shelley also stated that David Ozer, then 27 years old, told her he was the one who approached the producer at A Current Affair to get the episode made in the first place.
And to have her own son, David, allegedly be the one pulling the strings to get the story on the air, it's a level of family collusion that is just dark.
So he was allegedly involved in a scheme with his mother to destroy a political career on national television. That's the allegation.
And this Shelley Silver was so scared of the Ozer family's connections that she left Long Island and had a judge conceal her new address. She was in constant fear for my safety.
It suggests a shared worldview where rules don't apply, where the media is a tool to be used against your enemies.
It really is. It's one thing to grow up with privilege. It's another thing entirely to grow up observing that the rules are malleable, that consequences are for other people.
The story with his mother and A Current Affair is particularly telling. He learns at a young age that the media isn't for reporting truth, it's a weapon to be wielded, and that your family's influence and power can protect you. When Shelley Silver, the witness, becomes so terrified, she has to go into hiding. What message does that send to a young, impressionable David? It teaches him that intimidation works. It normalizes a level of ruthlessness that most people would find horrifying.
That is a dark family story. What about the dad, Marty?
Well, he wasn't mentioned in that scheme, but he didn't avoid trouble entirely. Much later, in 2018, he was removed from his gig as executive director of the Ronald McDonald House Charities in Reno amid allegations of sexual harassment and financial misconduct.
Good grief. It's particularly damning when you consider the organization. The Ronald McDonald House is supposed to be a beacon of hope for families with sick children. To have that kind of scandal erupt there is just awful.
It is. And when you add in the father's own scandal later in life, it cements this idea that maintaining the appearance of respectability is all that matters. The charity work, the successful career, it's all a facade if underneath you're engaging in misconduct. David didn't just learn how to lie, he learned how to build the perfect, most respectable-looking house to hide the lies in.
So there's a definite pattern of, let's call it, questionable behavior surrounding the family.
A very clear one.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as they say.
It provides a kind of psychological blueprint for his own future behavior.
And you'd think that A Current Affair thing would hamper David's career, right?
You would think. Nope. He just kept rising. He became president of IDW Entertainment, oversaw hit shows like Wynonna Earp and Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Then he founded another company, Landmark Studio Group, where he produced a Nicolas Cage movie, Willy's Wonderland. He just kept failing upwards, or maybe scamming upwards.
He was Teflon. Nothing stuck. And this is when his web of lies just gets wider and more tangled, I assume.
Deeply tangled. He was juggling multiple cons at once, using the credibility from his legitimate projects to lure in victims for his fraudulent ones. It's a classic Ponzi-like mindset, always needing new money to cover old lies.
Exactly. The pattern of deception we saw with CC just repeated itself over and over with different people. Take Ross Meyerson, an Emmy-winning casting director. Ozer convinced him to quit his own successful business and join Strong Studios as an executive VP.
Let me guess, the money never came.
Never saw the salary or the signing bonus he was promised. Instead, according to Meyerson's lawsuit, Ozer just fed him a battery of lies as to why payment was delayed. It was a story a lot of people were hearing.
And people like Ross Meyerson paid the price, leaving a stable career for a complete fabrication. It's a devastating betrayal of professional trust. He didn't just steal money, he stole careers, opportunities, and people's sense of security.
And what was that story? What was the pattern?
It was a script he followed almost to the letter. If he owed you money, he'd promise payment was coming immediately. When it didn't show up, he'd vow to wire it. When the wire didn't happen, he'd say, "Oh, it must be a problem at your bank."
Always deflecting blame.
Every single time. Then he'd say, "Oh, it's a problem on my end. New account, but it's resolved now. Wire's on its way."
Then when that failed, it was, "Oh, the company was supposed to cover that. I'll call and rip somebody a new one." It was always someone else's fault.
That must have been infuriating for people. One victim told the reporter, she finally said, "Forget the wire, just mail me a certified check." Ozer texts back, "Great idea."
The next day, he sends her a FedEx tracking number.
And the package never appeared.
Never even entered the FedEx system. She complained, and he sent her a picture of the box he claimed he'd sent. Proof, see? It must be FedEx's fault. The lies just never stopped.
The amount of energy it must have taken to keep all these stories straight is mind-boggling. Separate phones, faked email accounts, phony tracking numbers. It's a full-time job just managing the deception.
So he's running these cons on writers, casting directors, people inside the industry, but then he gets even more ambitious.
Yes. Then there was a time he tried to pull the wool over the eyes of a former FBI agent.
You can't make this stuff up. An FBI agent?
Or retired one, but still. So in 2022, Ozer meets an investor named Robert Rochman. Rochman tells Ozer he should talk to his buddy, David Bilitier, the retired agent, who has a ton of great stories.
And Ozer sees dollar signs.
Of course. He thinks it'll make a great movie. And Bilitier's stories are legit. Years of undercover work infiltrating a Colombian drug ring. So Ozer says they need a strong writer, which will cost $125,000 for development money.
But that was never the point, was it? The con itself was the project.
Exactly. Okay, so they need to raise the cash.
Right, so Rochman and Ozer, the investor, agree to split it. They each put in $62,500. They even set up a meeting in LA with a real established writer named Terry Metalis, who worked on Star Trek Picard.
So far, so good. It looks like a real project.
It does. They have a great meeting. Everyone's enthusiastic. Rochman and Bilitier assume more meetings will follow, you know, to actually tell the writer all these stories. But Ozer just tells them Metalis is already hard at work. He keeps giving them updates. He's making good progress. He's already 60 pages in. It's great.
But they'd only met with him once, for an hour and a half.
Exactly. They question how he could write so much. And Ozer just says, "You don't understand how writers work. It's the process." Months go by with these fake updates.
So finally, Bilitier, the ex-FBI agent, decides to do some investigating of his own.
He calls Metalis directly, asks him how the script is going, and he's met with just stunned silence. Metalis says, "I haven't heard a word from Ozer since our meeting. He never paid me, so I assumed the deal was dead."
So Ozer just took the money. He took Rochman's $62,000 and never paid the writer. And that must have been a gut-wrenching call for Bilitier to make. Here's his project based on his life's work, his legacy, and he discovers it's all been a sham. The money is gone and not a single page has been written.
The irony is intense. An FBI agent, whose job was to uncover deception, finds himself the victim of a Hollywood con man. It just proves that anyone, no matter how well-trained or skeptical, can be taken in by a master manipulator.
Correct. And when they confront him, furious, what does he do? He blames the writer, says Metalis is a crazy creative type and that he'd hired a new, better writer for them. And somehow, he convinces them to meet this new writer.
This guy's ability to talk his way out of things is remarkable. It's a superpower.
It is. So they start the process again with this new writer. He actually writes a full treatment. But the money from Ozer, same old story. Wires don't go through, bank problems, etc. But this time, Ozer deflects and says the funding is coming from a new partner.
And this is where the impersonation scheme really kicks into high gear. He's not just lying about delays anymore. He's creating entirely fictional characters and business relationships to prop up his house of cards. Let me guess who this new partner is. JB?
The one and only. Ozer connects the writer with JB, the noted producer from Dallas. The writer exchanges emails, talks on the phone a few times with the man he believes is JB, and his concerns are eased.
A real person, mind you, whose identity he effectively stole to lend his scam credibility. It's identity theft in service of fraud, but it's just Ozer on another burner phone.
We can assume so. The writer eventually loses patience and happens to reach out to a mutual colleague he has with the real JB. He complains about not getting paid. The colleague is shocked, calls the real JB, who has no idea what he's talking about.
And the whole thing unravels.
Completely. They conference the writer in, and he immediately realizes the voice of the real JB is not the voice he's been talking to. He'd been duped. They even did a GoDaddy search and found the fake email domain used to impersonate JB had been set up the morning of the writer's first interaction with him.
That's the smoking gun. And that must have been the final straw for everyone involved. It's the digital paper trail. In the old days, a con man could disappear. But now, every fake email, every domain registration, every burner phone ping leaves a trace. He was building his own prison cell with every lie he typed.
Which led to his downfall. That was it. And they were especially furious because all this time, while he's running these new cons, he's telling them the original safe haven charges are just a misunderstanding. But in reality, he was preparing to plead guilty.
The walls are finally closing in.
They are. On July 30th, 2024, Ozer signs a plea agreement. He admits he intended to defraud and obtain money from the Safe Haven production. He admits to taking about $137,000 from one account and $78,000 from another.
So he's confessed to the original crime.
Pretty much. In exchange for admitting to this whole range of deceptions, he was charged with just two counts of wire fraud. One for Safe Haven and one for all the new stuff.
And the sentencing? Well, he didn't exactly get what was coming to him.
On May 6th, he finally appeared in court and pled guilty. He was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison and ordered to pay almost $400,000 in restitution. On July 14th, he surrendered to the Federal Bureau of Prison.
But just 18 months for all of his crimes and deception? Let's face it, there was decades of lies and cons on his part. It doesn't seem like much of a punishment. The maximum was 40 years.
It's a common outcome in these complex fraud cases. The prosecution bundles a wide range of crimes under a simple, provable charge like wire fraud to ensure a conviction, even if it doesn't encompass the full scope of the harm done. And to tell you the truth, Sue, this happened to me very often during my career in federal law enforcement. I would spend a couple of years investigating some huge financial crime, only to have the assistant United States attorney reduce it down to one or two petty federal charges, and the crook would get little to no jail time. It is a very frustrating fact of life that continues to this day.
That's so sad, Nick, but I suppose it helps explain his confidence. He never broke character because, in his mind, he was always in control of the story. The slip-up with the burner phone, answering with his own name, must have been a terrifying moment for him, a crack in the fourth wall of his own production.
And what's his reaction? He doesn't confess. He doubles down, invents a new character named Keith from Minnesota on the spot. the compulsion to lie, to obfuscate, was so ingrained that it was his first and only instinct, even when caught red-handed. It's truly the mark of a career con artist.
So, while it feels like he got away with a lighter sentence, it was probably the most efficient way for the justice system to handle it.
Exactly. They secured the conviction and the restitution order, even if the jail time seems short for a lifetime of deception.
It doesn't feel like much, and that restitution, it doesn't even begin to cover everyone. So many people who claimed to be victims weren't included in the federal case. That second writer on the FBI project never saw a dime. The comedian Kerry Carravas was never paid for a special that's still streaming. Ross Meyerson, the casting director, never saw most of the money he was promised.
So the true financial damage is probably much higher.
Almost certainly. A few grand here, tens of thousands there. It's incalculable. And there's little evidence he's been humbled by any of this.
What do you mean?
Even after his plea deal, he was allegedly telling these bizarre, conflicting stories to explain his problems. He told one producer he stole the safe haven money because he was being blackmailed by a prostitute he ordered online. What? He told another group of people on a Zoom call this tearful story about a woman from Tinder who lured him to Vegas and was blackmailing him. But when they asked him why he paid the blackmailer, if she'd already sent damning emails to his wife and kids, he had no answer.
The lies just never stopped, even when there was no escape. And the stories don't even make sense. They're full of holes. He's not even a good liar at the end.
It's the final act of a narcissist. He can't accept responsibility, so he has to invent these elaborate, sordid tales to paint himself as a victim. It's a desperate attempt to salvage some shred of sympathy, even after he's confessed, because the lies aren't for the audience anymore. They're for himself. It's the only way he can process his own downfall by creating a fiction where he was the one who was wronged.
This is a big problem.
Never. One victim said every conversation with him was filled with kernels of deceit. He just couldn't tell the truth. And now he's serving his sentence at FCI Otisville in New York, inmate number 3626641-511. He'll be locked up until late 2026.
And the disrespect to the FBI agent, David Bilitier, is just astounding. Here is a man whose entire career was about navigating deception and danger, whose life story was deemed worthy of a major motion picture. Ozer didn't see a respected lawman. He saw a mark and a source of intellectual property to dangle in front of other investors.
It's the ultimate con man's hubris to believe you can outsmart someone who was professionally trained to spot liars. But Ozer wasn't trying to beat him at his own game. He was relying on the fact that they were in his world now, the world of Hollywood, where Bilitier was the novice. He used his home field advantage to blind a man who is used to seeing everything.
Maybe the most severe consequence for him won't be the jail time, but the reputational damage. In Hollywood, that's everything.
That's right. Any future Google search will reveal that he is no longer a high-flying exec. He's a man who lied for decades, a producer who swindled money and made life hell for his victims. This is a convicted felon. This is David Ozer.
So now we know the end of the story. The persona he spent a lifetime building has been completely and irrevocably shattered. The charisma's gone, the connections are severed, and all that's left is the truth of his actions.
A cautionary tale for anyone in a business built on trust and relationships. In the end, the story he produced was his own downfall. A true Hollywood ending in a twisted way.
Just not the ending where the hero rides off into the sunset with a beautiful woman in his arms.
Nope, and it was the most expensive production of his life, and the only person who paid for it was him and his many, many victims.
And it raises a difficult question about justice in cases like this. 18 months in prison and a restitution order that doesn't cover all the victims? Does that truly balance the scales? He shattered careers. drained savings, and caused immense emotional distress over many years. The damage is far greater than the dollar amount in the plea deal.
It often feels like the system is better equipped to quantify financial loss than it is to account for the human cost. The years of anxiety his victims endured, the lost opportunities, the broken trust, you can't put a number on that. So while the prison sentence is a form of accountability, it can feel wholly inadequate when you consider the totality of the harm.
And that's often the lasting victory for the con man. Even when caught, the emotional and professional scars they leave on their victims last far longer than their prison sentence. The money might be paid back, but the trust, once so thoroughly broken, is almost impossible to fully restore.
Perhaps the most fitting punishment, as you said earlier, Nick, is the public nature of his downfall. In a town built on reputation, his is now permanently defined by the scam. That public record is a life sentence in a way.
It is, and it serves as a stark reminder for the entire industry. For every David Ozer, there are countless legitimate producers working tirelessly to bring stories to life. His actions tarnish the industry as a whole, making it harder for everyone to build a trust necessary for collaboration.
That's a crucial point. The real victims aren't just the ones who lost money. It's the entire ecosystem of writers, directors, and actors who now have to be even more guarded. It slows down the creative process and fosters an environment of suspicion instead of partnership.
It really does. It forces people to spend as much time vetting their partners as they do honing their craft.
You are so right, Nick. And at this point, we will have to put our own Hollywood ending on this one.
At least I get to ride off with a beautiful woman on my arms, my very own wife.
Wow, Nick, you are making me blush. Now, when you say ride off on your arms, where exactly are we riding off to?
That's easy. We're riding off to the kitchen so we can have lunch. Your husband is hungry.
Yikes. Now that is a true romantic Hollywood ending. With all that said, this is Sue saying bye for now.
And this is Nick. Thanks for tuning in to another fantastic episode from Behind the Scams.
And so ends another tale of glitter, greed, and deception beneath the California sun. David Ozer, once a Hollywood insider with the right contacts and the perfect smile, now an inmate with a number instead of a title card. The man who turned trust into a business model finally ran out of believers. But in this town, the illusion never really dies. Somewhere, another fast-talking dreamer is rehearsing their lines, ready to play the next part in the endless sequel called The Confidence Game. From the red carpets to the courtroom steps, it's a short walk. When the story's built on lies, this has been Behind the Scams, part of the SOS Media Network, where truth always takes center stage. Subscribe, share, and join Nick and Sue next time as we unravel another true story of charm, crime, and consequence. Until then, remember, in Hollywood, not everything that shines is gold. Sometimes, it's just the reflection off a very expensive lie.